and welcome to episode 44 of WB40, the weekly tech podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, and Chris Weston.
Well, hello there, Matt. Here we are for number 44. All the fours, 44. Isn't it a splendid number, 44?
It is. I've got nothing more interesting to say about it than that. But
well, it's six less than 50.
It is. It's a factor of 11. Is that right? I can't remember.
It is indeed. Yeah, so, awesome. What sort of a week have you had? Since we last got together, has it been a splendid one?
It has, yeah. The birthday celebrations over the weekend, which was all good fun. Not mine, my eldest. Had a really interesting catch up with somebody who was another speaker at Silicon Beach on Thursday last week, a lady called Amy Keane, who turns out is another sociologist, and we're plotting. And I actually wrote a blog about it tonight. It's an idea that we kind of loosely talked about, and then we've got somebody else who might be interested to create a conference at which nothing is what it seems, because conferences are so formulaic. Even really good conferences are very, very formulaic. So what if you basically tried to challenge everything about it, but not being an unconference, but I don't know what it goes beyond that. I've got one idea. There's a couple of experiments. And then I think Amy's got a few ideas. And then we've got a few other people. And there's some people I think, actually, now I can see some folk who might be interested in being involved in it as well. So this might be the latest project. I don't know yet. But that was good fun.
I've seen this, you see. I've seen this a couple of times. And I saw it recently. And you put I didn't read the article. I've been frightened to look, really. For fear of what I might read.
And then apart from that, just the usual, you know, madness, basically. But, and then trying to be able to keep track of exactly what's going on in politics at the moment, which is, we were talking just before we started this, that, you know, you've got a situation where a minister has gone to meet the prime minister of a country who have got incredible geopolitical significance without telling either the foreign office or the prime minister, and then when first accused of it lying and said no, she told the foreign secretary, and then backtracking on it and saying, well, no, I didn't, and going on holiday and having 12 business meetings on holiday. That is not a holiday. I think we should be really asking the question, why are we being run by people who think a holiday is something where you go and have 12 meetings? It's crackers.
It is bizarre, and I can't remember a time in my life where that wouldn't be immediate resignation and just retire to the back benches and just keep your gob shut for at least 10 years. Good grief! There's this business about Boris Johnson. Did you see this thing about Boris Johnson?
And oh, no, he said, this.
"So no, there was a lady who was on holiday in Iran. I think Iran, though."
Oh, he
said that she was training journalists, but she wasn't doing no such thing. And you can imagine, you know, training journalists in some of these places would be seen as sedition or some... And he's essentially got her into some serious trouble. But it's okay, you know, he'll probably crack a few jokes and get away with it. It's like that moment where all the letters fell off at the back of Theresa May's speech. That was a kind of incompetence metaphor, and all those metaphors are becoming real.
Well, yes, I've been thinking of being able to work out what it is that the wheels are coming off of at the moment, because I can't think of a vehicle that's got enough wheels to be able to...
Well, that's right. I remember somebody using a metaphor about the Liberal Democrats a few years ago, about somebody looking to hammer the last nail in the coffin but can't find anywhere to do it. So there are so many... Yeah. So many in there. So yes, it is a remarkable time, and I saw the Death of Stalin film at the weekend as well, which is not meant as an allegory for this, but there are lots of parallels. And I read an interview with, I think, Jason Isaacs, who's in it, who's really, really, really steals a lot of it as General Zhukov, and he said something on the lines of, no, it's not an allegory, but of course you could apply this to just about any period in history and there'd be something going on somewhere that would look a bit like all these kind of venal, ambitious, but also similarly and simultaneously petrified characters scrabbling for their lives, careers, and whatever there is. And it's And then, of course, we've got the Panama Papers. No, these aren't Panama Papers.
Paradise
these
are new Papers. Ones, aren't
they? Paradise Papers. And the Queen and her offshore. And then it's Apple, apparently, the latest ones to come out. Apple has got some money in the Channel Islands. Or it's Lewis Hamilton and his jet, you know, and all that. I mean, how Lewis Hamilton, how they are, the idea that Lewis Hamilton is a British sports hero who's never paid any tax in this country and just spends his life as a tax exile. I don't know. But, yeah, the whole thing is just, it's just non-stop. It's like every hour you look at the news and something else has happened. Apart from just terrible, you know, shootings in the US, which seems to be a daily occurrence. And then the picture of, I'm rambling on at the moment, that picture of Donald Trump. Did you see this picture of him and Abe? They've gone to ceremonially feed the koi carp. They were given boxes of fish food and little spoons. And they were spooning it out, and this is the way. And Trump gets bored of this and just empties the box into the pot in a display of, I don't know what you'd call it, just
trumpery.
Yeah. So yes, it's been riveting watching.
It's remarkable, isn't it? It's a complete distracted attention from things like the interest rate increasing by 100% last week.
Yes, I know. I'm not entirely sure what that meant to achieve, but no doubt it's a precursor of what's to come.
Yeah, who knows? I'm very impressed, though, that you get to go out and watch erudite and sensible films, whereas for me, the next film I know that we've got on our agenda is going to be Paddington 2. but actually, I'm quite looking forward to it. Okay, so this week we're going to do one of those ones where we have a couple of subjects to talk about. And the first one is, if anybody is listening to this who knows me, will know that this is a particular hobby horse of mine. So stand back. But it's about how measurements and the obsession that we have in modern business with measurement is, to my mind, increasingly the problem of modern business rather than the answer that is often proclaimed to be. There's an old truism that says that if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. And it's misquoted to loads of people. I often see it attributed to Deming, I think, management theorist. I've never been able to find actually the source of it. So I think from that, we can just say it's probably made up nonsense in the same way that if you put brown paper and vinegar onto a bruise, it'll sort out bruising. But it's come up for me recently in a couple of conversations, one with a marketing agency, and the key challenge that they've got is they need to be able to prove the value of design. And it's one of those things where you just know that the people that they're dealing with in big corporates are going to be the sorts of people who have metrics and targets coming out of their ears, so they need to be able to make sure they can understand what the suitable metrics are for being able to measure whether something expensive, like actually designing things to be useful or nice or pretty, might be in any way valuable. And so they equate value to numbers, and then they can't stick a financial value on it, and therefore they get swamped in trying to find out suitable proxies, and by the end of it, nobody knows what the point is anymore. That's one of them. The other one is somebody asked me a few days ago, so what are common measures of success for BI programs, a business information, business intelligence programs. I think that's a fascinating meta example where how do you know that the investment that you've made in a system to be able to provide data to show how successful investments are is in itself a successful investment? And it's a bit like the thing that I've often said about big data, which is, where is the big data to tell you that big data is a thing you should invest in? And of course, the answer to that is there isn't any. But I just see all this stuff still coming around and around again, and I'm getting more and more convinced as I get older and grumpier that we have a real crisis because measurement doesn't help. What it does is it either ends up leading you to be able to focus on the wrong things because they're the things you can measure, or even worse, it ends up with really bizarre kind of paradoxical and poisonous outcomes. There's this concept of the cobra effect, which I think is possibly an apocryphal story, but it's a good metaphor if nothing else. And the story goes that in British ruled India pre-1947, was it, when India last achieved its independence, but they had in one of the big cities apparently a problem with cobra, and cobra were haunting the streets of this city, so that there was something that needed to be done. And the British authorities decided that what needed to be done was there to be a bounty issued for all cobra that were caught and captured and handed in and killed. And so what happened was that because there was money on the table, people started to farm cobra, because if you're going to get money paid for cobra, then you will find that people will take up the somewhat risky occupation of farming the things to be able to get the money. The problem was now the authorities realised they had a really different problem on their hand, which was people fraudulently claiming the cobra bounty. And so at that point, what they said was, we're not going to pay a cobra bounty anymore. At which point, all the cobra farmers said, well, screw this. This is an exceptionally dangerous thing to do. We're not going to do it because there's no value in it anymore, and let all the cobras out. By which time, there really was a massive cobra problem in the city. And that's all this kind of thinking, where if you put tangible measures and rewards for goals hit, you will end up with what you want. And actually, almost inevitably, you won't. Another really good example is just front of mind, a fantastic American podcast called This American Life. And my favourite ever podcast ever has just had a rerun. I'll put a link to it on the webpage. But it just spends a month in the life of a US car dealership. And if you want to see what happens when you set measures and targets and end up with ridiculously perverse behaviours, listen to that hour of fantastic documentary broadcasting and see just this crazy behaviour, all because incentivization based around targets has ended up becoming self-defeating, and therefore you end up with the most ludicrous panic selling and people buying cars for themselves and all sorts so they can hit monthly targets, which means that they'll get a big payout, which means that all the cars that have been sold less than cost will then actually turn them a profit from Chrysler at the end of the month. It's absolute insanity. You don't have to look far in most businesses to be able to find this kind of madness going on a daily basis.
No, you don't have to look far at all. And in fact, there was part of the reason why we haven't got a government in, or a devolved government in Northern Ireland at the moment is for that very reason, isn't it? This business of the
the fuel allowance thing, which was being able to
farmers buying biomass boilers, and heating outdoor buildings which have no need to be heated, because there was a subsidy around it. And as you say, it's just short-sighted fag packet economics. And so why does it happen? So there's a political example. And the cobra example is essentially similarly sort of political example where somebody comes up with a bright wheeze but doesn't think it through in order to solve a particular problem or achieve a particular social outcome. And then you get the commercial ones like the cars, or I've done some work over the years in FM, facilities management, as you know. And a lot of the work that I've done is around finding ways to bend IT to manage measures that have been agreed in contracts around performance. And every single time you see these things being, well, gamed to a certain extent, but even if they're not gamed, they don't exhibit the right behaviours, or they don't bring out the right behaviours. So, for example, you could have a hospital where if something is reported, a light bulb is a light is blown or something, so you report it to your help desk, and then the contract will say, well, what are we going to? We're going to give you a KPI, because KPIs are really important. KPI on how you're going to deal with this. Some will say, your KPI is from the moment it's reported to the moment you turn up to deal with it. Some will say it's from the moment you report it to when it's fixed. But there's all sorts of problems around, well, we could turn up and then we can't get there, or they could turn up in these spare parts. So you genuinely have some of these contracts where it is on first attend. So you can, as long as you turn up within 10 minutes or an hour or whatever it might be, doesn't matter how long it takes you to actually resolve it, as long as somebody's turned up, even if they don't have the skills to deal with it, it doesn't matter, because somebody's turned up. And people will run these contracts, and they'll play to the rules, because of course the cost to change things like that is massive in terms of legal costs. Everybody's got to get around a table and agree an amendment to a contract. It's much less hassle just to carry on and make the best of it. And maybe the outsourcing movement, if you can call it a movement, I guess, you know, over the years, of how outsourcing has grown and gone in and out of fashion in various businesses. But maybe that outsourcing piece has driven a lot of this, because in order to outsource something, you've got to find a way to measure your outsourcer. You've got to find a way to measure the people who are doing it. And because you aren't, they're not your employees, where we might manage people in quite subtle ways, with encouragement or disapproval or various other different or various ways to incentivize or disincentivize people who are your employees who you work with all the time, when it comes down to a contractual relationship with an outside third party, you have to kind of simplify it down, don't you? It can't be around any intangible item. It's got to be about money being paid for a thing, and then you have to boil it down in sometimes in quite silly ways.
Yeah, I guess the thing is, though, it's about treating people like mechanisms rather than realizing that they're part of organic systems. I think that's the challenge I see. So as you were saying that, I think traditional outsourcing models where you've got effectively a bespoke service being delivered for an organization because it's whatever it was that was there before. And that's where this stuff goes completely haywire. However, it is perfectly possible to be able to outsource to a commodity or a utility in a way where it doesn't matter. I can consume electricity perfectly happily, but actually because the thing there that I'm consuming isn't a human system. There are massively complicated human systems in providing it, but they're completely focused on the one thing, which is getting electricity through a pipe, wire. You know what I mean. And if you think about that in terms of something like, you know, cloud-delivered software, you know, I know what I buy when I'm buying Google Apps or when I'm buying Office 365 or I'm buying my financial accounting package or whatever else it is, because there's no human interaction involved. It's a product, if not a utility, you know, utilitized commodity thing that's almost interchangeable. And so all of the stuff that is about the complexity and the challenge of human systems is all behind the scenes. It's not something that I need to worry about. Until something goes wrong, and then you realise that actually the human system's part of crap. So if your electricity supply goes wrong, and then you try to get in touch with them. Or, God, having to get a thing that will only be dealt with by Openreach, sorted out on cabling, on domestic telephony. The only way to do it is to find a Openreach engineer who will do work on the side and get him to do it on the sly for you, as I found out this weekend.
I can't believe there are such things.
Fantastic, and actually cheaper than calling out Openreach themselves, even though you can't possibly do that. And they're just these crazy setups. But the point is that you can rely on numbers if it is something that generates. I guess what I have the distinction between natural data and synthetic data. So something like how much voltage is coming through the supply circuit into my house, 240 volts plus or minus, at 60 or so hertz, that's natural data to be measured. Can I measure something like how long does it take for somebody to respond to fix my problem? Well, there's no natural quality to that. It's all going to be completely subjective. It's all going to be completely synthetic data. And the minute you get into synthetic data, then you get into problems of gaming and of meaning change and a whole bunch of things that are usually where this kind of obsession with measurement really goes off the rails.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's two things that brings to mind. One is this idea then of when people start to negotiate these contracts or find ways to measure people is they start to think about risk and reward. And somebody was asking the other day about risk and reward around cloud service, around a platform. And every time I think about those things, I think about, well, financial penalties around non-delivery of certain stuff is meaningless. You know, it's like your telephone, you know, your mobile phone or something. If your mobile phone goes off and it doesn't come back on, it doesn't really matter to you. You know, it'd be good if you got your money back for that month's contract. But what you really want is a phone. And you take it to the extreme. It's like me saying, well, what is it today? It's the 6th of November, is it? The 6th of November. And I say, well, sadly, Matt, the oxygen is going to run out and we can't get any more oxygen until the end of the year. But I tell you what, next year I've got that oxygen screwed down to half price because of their lack of delivery. It's no good to you then. It's over. Risk reward only works when there's a when it makes sense. It just doesn't work otherwise.
And a brief insight there into the dystopian future post-Brexit as well. Thank you for that, Chris.
Yeah, I think you'll be glad of of my oxygen provision service at that stage, and you'll pay through the nose.
Quite literally.
Quite literally. So I there was a second point I was going to make there what's natural. So I think it comes down to sometimes about when, you know, have you ever done this where you start a project, and before you start the project, especially if it's a change project, transformation project, you kind of say, well, look, what are we going to say a successful project looks like? And you could have you know, quite simple thing to say, okay, we're going to install, okay, we're going to do a software account system migration, and it's going to happen on the 1st of March. And so what does a successful project look like on the 1st of March? And you say, well, okay, so we've got new software, and people have been trained, and it's live, and we can transact purchase ledger and sales ledger and cut invoices on the 1st of March, right? That's fair enough. Sometimes, though, you can't necessarily nail it down quite as much as that. Sometimes it's about, well, how will it feel? How will it feel when we are better, when we have, I don't know, we've revamped our sales process? And the sales director might say, well, you know, I will feel that I know I've got a much better idea halfway through the month how my guys are getting on, or guys and girls are getting on with their targets. And sales people will say, you know, I will feel that I now understand what I'm trying to achieve, and I understand when I go into a customer, what that customer's doing, what their requirements are, whether there's any problems that I should be aware of, I'm not walking into a minefield or whatever. People describing how they feel is often a much more powerful method of measuring success than sort of raw data. But it is hard to write a contract around.
Yeah, and this is one of the big, I think one of the big challenges of things like Agile method in an outsourced contract model, which is it's really bloody hard to be able to contract for it all, because the assumption is going to be tie things down, but then you want to measure on outcomes rather than in terms of activities or inputs. So therefore, we don't want to just get a time and materials contract, because how do we know they'll deliver anything of value? And it's like, well, to be honest, if you're starting with a question about whether you don't think they're going to deliver stuff of value, then you're not going to get anywhere anyway. I mean, the lack of trust that therefore is involved is, I mean, that's tantamount to everything in this, isn't it? The larger the organisation, the less trustworthy they become, and the less trusting they become. It's both ways, and less trusting equals less trustworthy often as well. It becomes a self-fulfilling, I don't trust you, therefore I'm not going to do things that would implicitly say that I trust you, therefore you won't trust me, therefore we get to the point where we have fulfilled on delivering our expectation that you're both shit.
And absolutely. I mean, that for example, go back to the FM example, that would happen a lot in PFI contracts. So PFI, 25 years, right? Okay, you draw up a contract, you know, that you can, there's a foot tall if you put it on the table. Massive, massive contract. Everything dotted, I's dotted, T's crossed, everything measured. And then when you start the contract, the start of your 25 years, you realise actually this doesn't quite work, right? And I might have used this example before. Catering, for example, in a hospital. So you say, right, you're going to provide 3 meals a day for patients, and then you're going to provide the dinner at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock. And then the latest, if somebody comes in after 8 o'clock into a ward, then they don't get any dinner, they get breakfast, right? Okay, so that's the contract. And then you get people coming in into a bed maybe not into an intensive care or anything like that, but into a ward, but they need to be in hospital. They're coming at 9 o'clock, and they've been trapped in a car since early that day, right? So maybe they've got a broken leg, or they've got things they need to be dealt with. Otherwise, they're healthy, they could eat, and they're very hungry, right? Because they've been in a car all day, they've been nothing else to happen, and they're coming at 8:30. So the nurse on the ward, the sister, says to the catering, can you provide a meal? And they say, what are they going to say? Are they going to say, oh, sorry, mate, you're joking, it's past 8 o'clock, you don't get anything until breakfast? Doesn't happen that way, does it? People go, well, do you know what, we do need to feed this person. So in that case, what you have to do is you have a bit of give and take. So the people running those contracts, the contract manager from the PFI side and the contract manager from the catering side, they'll come to an agreement. I say, look, yeah, of course, we'll cover that if that happens. But you need to give me a little bit of leeway on this because this doesn't quite work for us. And over time, you get all these kind of little workarounds and you get a gentleman's agreement, if I'm going to use that patriarchal term, around how you operate. And everything's going okay. And then suddenly, somebody will be replaced. For whatever reason, somebody will leave their job. Their new broom comes in and they're told, we need to make some savings in this. And it could be on either side. And they look at the contract and they look at what they're doing and they go, why are we doing this? Why are we doing that? We can stop all that. We don't need to. We're not paid to do that. Stop doing that. And then the other person on the other side feels that they've been let down. You know, we had an agreement. Well, I'm sorry, but I've got a job to do. I've got savings to make. And then so the other side then stopped doing everything they were doing, and then nobody gets the service thereafter. And then everything has to build up again. And as you say, because at that point trust breaks down. Trusted brick builds up, and then it breaks down. And if you get into that situation, guess what? It's the poor sod who's hungry. It doesn't get fed. It's the people who need the outcomes that don't get them.
And it's this point about how all of this is dependent on the mythical idea that in a human organisation you can know exactly how it all works, because you take a mechanistic approach to understanding of organisation rather than an organic approach to it. And this is why, say, for example, on Wednesday and Thursday this week, there's going to be RMT action on South Western Railways, or whatever they're calling themselves these days. And it will be a complete nightmare. And it will be a complete nightmare because what happens is people start to use that form of industrial action, which was popular in the 70s and is popular now because it's extremely effective, called work to rule, which is where you all start working to exactly the rules in the system. Now, of course, we're being told at the moment there's this great, you know, utopian future where everything will be automated and everything will work and artificial intelligence will take over and it will all be amazing and we'll all have to just spend 2 hours working, sitting by the pool or something. Or dystopian version of that where we're all out of work and nobody has any work to do. In either case, it's just not that it assumes that all of the stuff that currently is woolly and imprecise can be factored out. And people will turn and they'll look at things like Uber, which is basically just an app for the ordering of taxis. Or they'll look at Amazon, which is basically just a shopping app that if you get to buy something that you'd only buy once in a blue moon, you will get recommended others on it. That's as intelligent as that gets, because everything it assumes is a bit like a book. And you know, these are phenomenal systems and services, don't get me wrong. But they're so simple in comparison, and you can't reduce everything down into these simple mechanistic things. It just doesn't work.
I do like that. I like that idea that the future, if it's AI, is essentially everybody working to rule all the systems. That's, as you say, that's a negative outcome. I almost use the word didactic then, but you know, it's very, it's kind of, yeah, I think that's a really good analogy, and I shall use it in future. Because excellent. I think the work to rule thing is quite right, and it's the idea that we can work in that way and boil everything down to algorithms it's for the birds at the moment, isn't it?
No, absolutely. It's an over rational approach that humanity has gone through a few of these cycles, and then people realise actually, oh no, it's a bit more complicated than that. So it's, I think, fair to say that all this stuff is the reason why the current sort of techno-utopian or techno-dystopian future that is being portrayed and nobody seems to be challenging is not being challenged, but should be, because it's nonsense. So in our current technologies, I do not believe that we're ever going to see these levels of artificial intelligence and automation that are being talked about at the moment, for the simple fact that people don't work like that. And then people who might want to challenge that, for the most part, don't have the technical understanding to have the confidence to be able to challenge the current prevailing wisdom about where technology is taking us. And those people who do have the understanding about their technology are acolytes. They believe in it. They are followers of the singularity and the great church of Kurzweil, and therefore believe all this shit's going to happen. So we've got this weird situation at the moment where there's an imbalance of information that means that the more likely outcomes aren't being posited in the world because the people who are likely to believe them aren't going to understand the necessarily the nature of the technologies that mean that they won't challenge and da-da-da-da. So, you know, Chris, you were saying you're listening to the Today programme tonight, and sorry, the PM tonight, and you know, big discussion with people like James Burke about the future of automation, and it's just all this kind of
rah-rah
at the moment.
Yeah. And James Burke, I mean, it was really interesting, and you know, repeating quite a lot of what we heard in the past. A little bit hyperbole around the number of jobs that were going to be displaced, and the fact that are we going to need to pay people minimum basic income and all of that kind of thing. But based on some of the, like, we're kind of extrapolating from some of the things that we've seen. And there was an article on the BBC. Did you see about robot lawyers?
Yes.
With a graphic featuring the ubiquitous android and then holding a gavel, which even judges don't use, never mind lawyers. And it was citing articles about the fact that this artificial intelligence thing had managed to figure out, I don't know, something about, okay, we're gonna submit these cases to arbitration or to court or something, and the AI could, or maybe it was computation claim for PTI or something, and the computer could come up with a better hit rate in terms of what would get compensation rather than what wouldn't, and because of that means that all lawyers will be out of a job, all of the kind of, I don't know, mid-ranking, low-ranking lawyers, you know, those kind of people that do your conveyancing for you when you move house, they lose their jobs, and it's just the wise old owls who are there to look after it all will be retained, which kind of loses sight of the fact that in order to become a wise old owl, a lawyer or an accountant or anything, you've probably gone through an apprenticeship and you've done all that grunt work, and that's given you the insight and the ability to critically think about stuff. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in the position you are. Nobody just drops into one of those jobs.
Yeah, I mean that was something that I talked with people in the law industry, the legal industry, last year when I was doing a piece of work with one of the sort of mid-sized law firms, and it's a bit of both, really. Actually, an awful lot of that grunt work isn't done by trainee lawyers; it's done by paralegals. So it's done by people who aren't fully qualified lawyers. They have enough to be able to get by, but they don't have the full set of qualifications. And they're just seen as an unnecessary cost by partners in law firms, and they want to try to be able to get the cost out there. But the issue with these sorts of machine learning intelligence things at the moment is that they're basically just statistics machines. And they're working on the basis primarily of correlation without understanding any causality. So they work for as long as they work, and then they will stop working at some point, and nobody will have the first idea why. And that's a big problem in something like law or medicine or any of the other professions, because if something like that just suddenly stops working, you know, people die and stuff. I did a little experiment. I wrote about it last week, actually. I just had an idle moment where I thought, I wonder what skills I need to be able to, what knowledge and information do I need to be able to pursue getting started with artificial intelligence? So I did a bit of search on the internet, and the things that came back were statistics, maths. There was stuff around data structure, data science, data management. There was stuff around programming. There was stuff about APIs. There was stuff about more maths and a bit more maths. And that long list, the thing that struck me about it was that for something claiming to be intelligence, it was incredibly skewed to a very, very, very narrow set of human pursuits. There was no art, there was no philosophy, there was no ethics, there was no psychology, there was no sociology, there was no concept of anthropology, there was nothing about history, there was nothing about geography. You know, the list goes on. And that we have this very, very, very one-dimensional approach at the moment to what is intelligence. And it's not to deny there's not use in this stuff, but it's not the same as actual intelligence by such a long margin.
No, that's very true. And I think that reminds me of something that somebody said, I think I read it last week, was about if you're looking for funding, you call it AI. If you're looking for developers, you call it machine learning, because it's just a different way of describing it. And you're right, it is a statistics machine. I think one of the developments that's coming at the moment around quantum computing is that is an application that you can see changing the way AI works, in as much as because of the and as much as I understand about quantum computing, because of the way it works, it doesn't work in that linear way that statistics engines and ML at the moment has to work, because that's the kind of kit it operates on. It kind of works on every single, or pretty much most outcomes at the same time. I saw it described as if you're playing Angry Birds on a normal sort of smartphone and computer, what you do is you take your little bird and you stretch the little elastic and you let it go. And because the computer knows what angle the bird is at, and it knows the distance you pulled it back, and therefore the impetus you want to put into it, it kind of worked it out then. It can calculate the trajectory and all of those kind of things. Whereas a quantum computer will know all of the trajectories it could go in at the same time, but it doesn't do anything except for the one that you've selected. A little bit like...
those cameras, I can't remember the name of them, but there's been one that's been into mass production, which a normal camera, it records the light at the point at which the lens hits the light through the lens hits in a digital camera, the sensor at the back. But there's this different sort of camera that basically contains circuitry that enables it to just collect all the light that's coming through from any lens position. So therefore you can set focal depth at any point and focus at any point afterwards. You've got all the data captured so that you can say, I want to focus on that thing in the far distance, or I want to focus on that thing in the foreground, and you can make that decision afterwards. Does that work?
I think that's a handy metaphor. It's not quite right, because that's still a linear process. It's just using some very, very cool calculations. It's a bit like the kind of things that they used for the Hubble telescope, for example, when the mirror was all shagged, wasn't it, when they sent it up, and then they had to replace bits and bobs. But actually, quite a lot of the work they did was post-processing of the images, to the point where, because they knew what the distortion was, they could then, because the computing power got better and better and better after launch, they could then produce these brilliant images, even though the mirror was all wonky. And a bit like, so I've seen some demonstrations recently of the latest upscaling tech that takes a low res image and creates a 4K image, and it's introducing artifacts that aren't there. Somehow it's introducing stuff that isn't there from the information it's got. And that, you know, again, it's linear computing technology, but it's kind of, that's the kind of similar kind of thing. Whereas you've heard of the idea of the qubit, the way it works, and this idea that it's a quantum bit, and therefore it doesn't exist as a one or a zero. It can exist in a kind of a, almost a sphere, not even a linear scale between one and zero. And then it can be whatever it needs to be. And this is part of the problem with actually programming these things and using these things, in as much as there's a massive error rate in a lot of the quantum computers that have been built at the moment, because it's very hard to actually understand what on earth they're saying. But such is the power, is you can use the same power to kind of do all the error correction. A bit like, is it MP3 or something? MP3 is about 90% error correction or something, and 10% music, maybe. I'm making that up. But there's a lot in the quantum computing field at the moment, there's a lot of error correction going on. And then there's different types of quantum computing. Some is I don't remember them. There's some that's super cooled, and that is does a job in one way. And then there's some that's not super cooled. It's got something to do with bonded ions or something. And they all have their drawbacks, but they all work in this very, very different way. And I was listening to James Burke today, and I was thinking, but you know what? You know, and he did talk about the fact that we've got these 10 zillion neurons and then X grillion dendrites. Dendrites, is that right?
You're
word?
Making these numbers up. This is the sort of thing that children talk about.
Yeah. The grillion isn't a number I'm familiar with in science, but there's a lot of them. It's like the joke about George W. Bush, which, of course, all these jokes are now redundant because of Trump, but somebody says to George W. Bush, bad news, Mr. Bush. The UN have just reported that 3 Brazilian troops have been killed in Uganda. And he goes, oh, my God, how many is in a Brazilian? there's that kind of thing. There's all these massive numbers.
We have the best Brazilians. Oh, but, I look. Sorry, but you just look back to those days of George W. Bush and his childish naivety, and you think, "Oh, that was yeah, a happy." Who'd have thought that? Yeah. Anyway, sorry, I digress.
He was a statesman of the most sober and superb statesman in comparison. But no, I think that some of these technologies will make a big difference to how we think about how we implement AI. God knows how at the moment. I haven't got the brain to think about it, but everything I've read about quantum computing reminds me of a quote attributed to Niels Bohr, who said, if you aren't shocked by quantum physics, then you don't understand it. And I think everything I've read about quantum computing suggests that if you're not shocked by what quantum computing means, you don't understand it. And I still don't understand it, and I'm still shocked.
I think that I mean, it's one of those technologies that is such a different step change in how things are. It is the first time. I mean, computing is basically what computing has been since the invention of certainly assembler, and definitely since the sort of third generation languages in the, 50s and 60s with BASIC and Fortran and Pascal. And, you know, you can look at computer code today, and object-oriented made it a bit different in the 90s. Even the 80s, actually, Smalltalk sort of came out around the late 80s, didn't it? But it's not really. All it's been has just been this massive increase in available power because it's got bigger and cheaper. But the core fundamentals have not changed.
That's because processor architecture hasn't changed in that time. Processor architecture is exactly the same as it ever was, essentially. You've got a bit of risk here and there, and it's all essentially the same. This is a such a shift, and it's like physics. It's like being a Newtonian physicist suddenly being told that that's all very well, but that's not how it works down here. We've got things that don't exist until you measure them, and we've got things that can be in two different places at once and can have spooky entanglements between different particles. And it helps to understand quantum physics before you start to. I mean, again, I'm not a quantum physicist, but I've got an understanding of it. It helps to understand that before you start understanding quantum computing. There's a really good book actually on sort of simple explanations of some of this fundamental stuff, which I shall put a link to on the website, because if anybody's thinking of understanding quantum computing, they'd do well to read this bit
but,
first.
But whilst this is still very, very much in the lab at the moment, there is one area where it might have a quite dramatic effect quite quickly, and that's in terms of our current understanding of how to encrypt and encipher things.
Yeah, absolutely. Because quantum computers are very, very good at doing calculations very quickly, because we currently encrypt things using
prime numbers,
essentially encryption based on prime numbers, which would take normal computers years to crack. Quantum computers can do that in no time at all, and essentially it breaks all the encryption on the internet. That is one of the potential outcomes of quantum computing, which is, according to very many very credible people, only 18 months, 2 years away. And that's one of the shocking things that I kind of think about. Think of the number of transactions that happen on the internet today, which are run over HTTPS, that are considered secure because they really, really are. And then imagine that not being secure anymore. Now, I'm not saying that's a definite outcome, but it's certainly a very possible outcome, and something I can imagine, you know, clever people that think places like GCHQ and in banks and anywhere that uses internet for transport of sensitive information is thinking of right now.
Well, there we go. That's encryption and particularly blockchain blown out of the water before it's even started. How hilarious.
We never really knew them.
So there we go. I wasn't sure where we were going this week. Sometimes it's like that, sometimes it isn't, but I think that was an interesting thing. I know I now have another set of reading on my to-do list because I know nothing about quantum computing and I know very little about quantum physics. But, you know, more for the Kindle. Next week, interestingly, we do have a lot more, well, I say planned, and it all depends on whether a meeting tomorrow happens or not, but I'm hoping, so I'm going to talk about it, we're going to get to have a conversation with a chap called Hilary Gallo, who I've known for a couple of years now, fascinating bloke, former lawyer, now works as a coach and consultant, his specialism is around negotiation. And he's got some fascinating views about what good and bad negotiation amounts to. And he's also somebody who has got a really interesting sort of ethical stance on things, particularly when it comes to the use of the language of war and violence in day-to-day conversation and particularly in language around business and how we really should not be thinking about using language of mass destruction when we're talking about things like accounts, which is, you know, or information security. That's the one that is always full of roughy-toughy talk about DMZs and the like, when actually it's quite geeky and not that actually interesting. So anyway, that will be next week's show. Between now and then, what you got on?
Well, this week I'm doing various things up and down the place, and I'm going to hopefully catch up with a CIO the end of the week for an interview that we might be able to get into a program the week after next, maybe. I shan't name him right now because I want to make sure I do actually meet up with him, and I do remember to take my recording gear and don't make a mess of it. But if I do get to do it, it will be a really good interview. And he's a guy whose writing and stuff I've admired for a while. So he's he'll be an interesting guy. So watch this space.
Fantastic. The other thing between now and then I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be trying to avoid tweets coming out of Gartner's symposium because they just annoy me.
Oh, hear, hear. I heartily endorse that sentiment.
Oh, charlatans. Anyway, good luck. Farewell. Have a good week. And we will speak next week.
So, thank you for listening. You can catch us, as always, on iTunes or on Stitcher or on the website, which is wb40podcast.com. And, of course, you can always get hold of us on Twitter at wb40podcast.